The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's The Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to The Space Show. It's great to be here. A couple of quick announcements. The first one is for everybody who will be listening to this program on Tuesday, October 17th. It is a replay. So do not phone in and do not use chat. But if you have a comment or question, send it by email and we'll do our best to get it answered for you as soon as possible. But again, remember, if you're listening on KKNW and any other way on Tuesday, then it is a replay because I am in Las Cruces at the XPRIZE Cup and the symposium festivities all week. Okay, and now to the regular announcements. If you want to call the program today, remember that we have a toll-free line. No call screeners. Let it ring until we can answer it. Be patient until we bring you up on the air. And that number is 1-866-687-7223. Email dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or thespaceshow@gmail.com. And you can use those email addresses if you're listening to the replay. No problem. And then for those of you who are listening on chat, the IM, ICQ, or CompuServe screen name, it's the same, all the same for all three, Space Show Chat, one word. Remember, the Space Show is a trademark and registered service mark for me. I have the copyright. You're free to download these shows, burn them to CDs, pass them around, share them. Don't do anything commercial. Don't change the text of any of the interviews. And then a couple of very quick announcements. Remember to visit our website, thespaceshow.com. Our newsletter is there. It's uploaded every Monday. It has all of the comprehensive things coming up for the Space Show. You can subscribe to the short form that just tells you what's happening during the week. Send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived. Remember to go visit the Space Show store. Hopefully you'll find some interesting items there. Give us your feedback. And remember, the Space Show is now a nonprofit, a 501c3. We're part of the One Giant Leap Foundation. We need your contributions and support. It's a big undertaking to do the program, just as it is to go to space. And we thank all of you who do support us and who will support us. A couple of very quick announcements coming up very, very quickly. International Symposium on Personal Spaceflight in Las Cruces, October 17th through the 18th. This is put on by Space Grant New Mexico, New Mexico State University, National Space Society. Remember, if you register for the symposium, you get into XPRIZE Cup for free. And the Cup is also in Las Cruces, October 20th through the 21st. Also at the symposium, remember, lots of veteran astronauts are there. You get to ask them a lot of questions, intermingle with them, find out what it's really like to fly and to be in orbital space. And one other thing, Buzz Aldrin will be at the symposium. So if you want to have a chance to meet Buzz and talk to him, show up. The next one is Transforming Space by the California Space Authority, November 29th through December 1st. That's in L.A. Then we're going back to New Mexico, STAFE Conference put on by the University of New Mexico, February 11th to the 15th. That's in Albuquerque. March 3rd through the 7th, this is the ProSpace March Storm Week. Check it out at www.prospace.org. Then March 19th through the 23rd is the California Space Authority Space Week in Washington. Check this one out at www.californiaspaceauthority.org. Meet the people who make the policy. Talk to them about space. Influence them. You make a difference. So both of these are really high-quality programs. Then we're headed back to New Mexico again. We might as well just move there. the second international conference and exposition on science, engineering, and habitation in space, and the elevator workshop, March 25th through the 28th. That's also in Albuquerque. And then we head to ISDC 2007, May 24th through the 28th in Dallas, Texas. I'm really pleased to bring to you one of my favorite guests who has been on the space show before. Not only is our guest a lot of fun and very, very bright and knows what she's talking about, it is always great to do a very, very high-quality reality check program. And I can't think of anyone better than Constance Adams to do reality checks with us on closed systems and living in space and what's involved. Constance is a specialist in high-performance architecture and design innovation, particularly in the area of the architecture necessary for human spaceflight. She currently is performing operations integration for the space station, and her work as an architectural consultant to NASA and Lockheed has sensitized her to the issues of human-machine interface, sustainable systems, the importance of biomimetric design, and the need for new ways of mitigating risk in the design and building professions. She's translated an early specialization in urban design and institutional architecture into a truly unique portfolio of designs for NASA's human spaceflight program, including two surface habitats for lunar Mars exploration, a long-duration crew transit spacecraft, a vehicle architecture for X-38 crew return vehicle, the larger crew transfer vehicle, and orbital space plane. Her work has been published in Metropolis, ID, Popular Science, Architectural Record, Spin, and other journals, and she has exhibited at the Art Institute of Chicago, the Yale School of Architecture. She has won NASA awards for her innovative technology and holds a design copyright on the first human-rated inflatable spacecraft. I can keep reading about her. I don't want to do that. I'd rather talk to her. Welcome back to the show, Constance. How are you?
I'm great, David. Thank you so much.
It is great to have you back, and it is always great to do reality check on the space show. And we have a break coming up in just a few minutes for KKNW, but here's the reality check question of the week. I have guests that come on the show and listeners that will send in questions, and they talk about their plans to go orbital in just a year or two, maybe 20 to 30 people. They talk about imitating or replicating the structure of Skylab. And the bottom line is, it's really easy to put all these people in a structure and orbit the Earth for fun, or maybe even take this structure and go visit someplace like Venus. I would like to know the reality of living in a closed system in space. The ISS kind of makes it look simple. I don't know if it is simple. I don't know if the ISS is primitive or advanced. What can you tell us about closed systems for a good reality check here?
Well, I guess let me start with the reconstruction of Skylab. If there's anybody out there who can do that, well, they probably can't do it in a year, but if they can do it ever, I would love to meet them. I would be extremely grateful if they would start the undertaking. Skylab is, as you know, or was, David, the third stage of a Saturn V rocket, which is the best rocket ever built, ever flown, the most powerful launch platform that we know of, and the drawings have been lost. So all of the efforts that NASA is undertaking now with the launch vehicles that are associated with Orion and with the Constellation program are attempts to cobble together something a fraction as powerful as a Saturn V was from pieces that we do have in current production or in recent flight tests. Certification. And, you know, I don't know anybody in the business who wouldn't be thrilled to have anything remotely like a piece of a Skylab available to them. So, yes, Skylab, it was relatively simple for the folks at the Johnson Space Flight Center, which was then still the Manned Spacecraft Center, as you know, to come up with designs with Raymond Loewy's help for outfitting that third stage. Why did they have the third stage available to them? Because it was the translunar injection stage, and since Skylab was only going to orbit, they didn't need the TLI fuel. So they had an oxygen tank and a hydrogen tank there. I believe it was hydrogen oxygen, but I may be wrong about the mix. I know that the smaller tank was oxygen, which they were able to keep intact with a small and insert a small airlock into it that the crew was able to use for trash. You know, something where every day today when we worry about having to jettison something from space station and the problems that, of course, we encounter if we should run across it again in the same orbit, every time we worry about do we have enough room in the next progress for our trash, what do we have in terms of returning spent equipment to the Earth or just getting it off of the space station so that they don't drown in their own waste. These are the kind of things that would be very luxurious to have on board today. And Skylab simply had it available because it was supposed to be the, I believe it was the Apollo 20 rocket. And after Nixon canceled the program, well, there were several of them lying around and available. So that's a reality check, I guess,
okay.
Or at least a genuine response to that part of your question.
Okay, well, hold it there. Hold it there. We have to take our first break because KKNW is pounding me with their music. But when we come back, I want to sort of understand a 101 basic on the differences of, say, the ISS and Skylab, and I think that's a good place to start when we come back. Everybody, we'll be back in 2 minutes with Constance Adams.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is your host, David Livingston, and our guest today, Constance Adams. So, Constance, when we think of these closed systems, is the space station primitive? Is it advanced? And I'm assuming it is significantly different than what Skylab was.
It is significantly different. I think, I mean, it all depends what your scale is to call it primitive or advanced. In truth, it's probably all quite primitive, and or we'll look that way, you know, 50 or even 100 years from now. And, of course, it takes so unbelievably long to get a technology tweaked to the point where it's capable of withstanding flight certification that by the time something actually does fly, it's typically about 20 years out of date. So the difference is, though, it works. What's interesting about Space Station is that, you know, if we had just built Space Station Freedom as designed, and it was designed specifically around its delivery vehicle. I mean, the truck that we had to build it with, right, was the space shuttle. And the space shuttle's payload bay was designed around the largest object that can travel on the federal rail and highway system, which is a 13.5-foot external diameter or outer diameter. So the space station modules are of that dimension, so as they can fit in the payload bay. And the whole system was designed together and of a piece. It wasn't until the accident of, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union and the Clinton administration's desire to keep Russian technologists in Russia instead of, you know, allowing all those programs to fall apart and encouraging their scientists to go work in places like Iran, that the deal was made to make it an international space station. And now half of it, of course, is Russian. Half of it is of an American design. Thank goodness, because the last few years without any shuttles flying, we wouldn't have had any access to it if there hadn't been also the old Soviet designs of the new Russian manufacturer supporting their half. Consequently, our systems also are half Russian systems, or in fact, at the moment, still predominantly Russian systems, most of which were designed in the mid-70s, really. They're Salyut class systems on Salyut-derived modules. So they have a long heritage. You know, they know exactly how they work. They haven't changed many things about them, which means they still break down a lot of the same ways that they used to. But that's a familiar failure, and definitely the thing I hear the most from folks who spent the most time in this program is that, you know, better the devil you know than the one that you don't. So we have our advanced systems are supposed to fly up in the next year or so, and these are what we would call advanced closed-loop systems, ones that are more regenerative in nature. And we've got some, you know, bioregenerative-based water reclamation systems. We've got some, we're hoping to get some advanced oxygen or gas exchange reclamation systems going up. We're still pretty far from closing that loop with solid waste. That's definitely not ready for exploration or even for testing on the space station. But so in terms of probably NASA's terminology, we're moving towards advanced systems soon, and we need to get them in place before we go on to the six-crew configuration. I fear that I may be drifting from the original point of your question, though.
I don't think so. You're explaining some of these challenges. So before we took the break, and you mentioned the trash a lot, the solid trash we still can't process and handle in space. It comes back. Is that what happens?
Yep. It comes back typically aboard a Progress or soon aboard an ATV or an HTV, which are the two automatic cargo vehicles that are being developed for the ATV by Europe and the HTV by Japan. Neither of those is a return vehicle in the sense that they both, like the Progress, burn up on return through the atmosphere. So basically we're incinerating our trash in a really expensive kind of way. But the downside being that once the shuttle stops flying, except for Soyuz, we won't have anything that can return anything to Earth, and a payload, a science payload, for example, just can't survive the kind of environment, the, you know, the shock and load environment of a reentry on Soyuz. So all the science that goes up is only gonna be returned to Earth in the form of telemetry, in the form of data. So a lot of the great experiments, I don't know if you talked at all or discussed any of the experiments that flew on STS-107, but I distinctly remember Laurel Clark was the prime mission scientist, mission specialist who was in charge of a cultured cancer cell that did some amazing growth in microgravity. And sometime, I think in like late April of 2003, they found the payload case, and it wasn't opened until August. And the specimen had continued to grow after it slammed through the atmosphere and into northern Louisiana. And so the result was a truly extraordinary piece of science returned, because you had in the base, in the root of it, some cells that had grown in microgravity during the 16 days of the Columbia mission. And then on the outside, surrounded by a growth that had taken place over the course of some 6 months on Earth. So you had an immediate and perfect scientific study of how the exact same cell forms in gravity and without gravity. That's the kind of thing we're not going to get once the shuttles aren't flying anymore. And I think it's underestimated what the negative impacts are going to be for science and engineering. And for our system.
And there's no way to do that type of science without a shuttle type of vehicle. The replacement vehicles just won't be able to do it.
Well, a ballistic reentry is very hard on everybody.
Right.
And it's really, there's virtually no way to design a science payload that's robust enough to support that and have all of the sensitive instrumentation that it needs to have. I mean, I'm sure that the payload developers are out there trying desperately now to figure out ways, and some may come up with things that will work. But it's even hard to convince researchers to fly their payloads up on a Soyuz, just because the vibrations are so much more intense than you're going to get on a shuttle. And a shuttle is a real luxury ride.
We had Larry DeLucas on a couple of months ago. I don't know if you know him or not, from Protein Crystal Growth in Space at the University of Alabama, Birmingham.
Well, I am familiar with his experiments, and they're great.
And he said, we can't come back on anything but a shuttle because
yep.
of we can't pull more than 4 Gs, and even that is sort of iffy. And they can't ride up because of the vibrations on the Soyuz.
Yep.
So they're between a rock and a hard place, and he's got pharmaceuticals that would invest and pay to do this, but they don't have any routine, reliable access right now. So it's not happening. And
people slam the shuttle program a lot, and it's true that it ended up, in fact, being more fragile and finicky than had been originally imagined. The funny thing is, I think, that it's precisely the sort of ordinary, everyday housekeeping aspect of a spacecraft and a spacecraft processing on the ground that was not foremost in the minds of the designers when they were putting that together, and that has really come back to haunt us on a daily basis. But the truth is, it's an extraordinary vehicle, and if you understand the history of the program, the goals as to how it was supposed to be developed, how many test articles there were supposed to be before the final design was settled upon and built, and then how that was all cut down such that Columbia really was the first real test, the first flight test article, and also the first flying orbiter. Isn't really the way that any good engineer would choose to run a program, and this is the problem with politics, of course. And I think, I often think that the real challenge that democracy has as a whole, in fact, I mean, what's funny is getting into this program, it makes me think about politics in a sort of larger historical time scale. It's a relatively young political form, isn't it? And
yeah.
We really haven't solved the problem of conducting great projects in a democratic system. Eisenhower dubbed the highway system under the National Defense Highway Act, and without which, during the Cold War, surely, in one or another congressional funding cycle, the budgets would have been cut or trimmed or pork barrels would have rolled out. But since it was a defense article and the Cold War was on, they were finished, even though it took 20 years to do it. can you imagine anything today? Can you imagine the government saying today, we're going to go to Mars in 20 years, so here's our funding structure, and you guys aren't going to touch it for the next two decades. The budgets are going to be, are going to be flat. People are going to be free to plan several years in advance and execute along those lines. There's not going to be this regular annual revision of the budget and what our goals are. As administrations change, they don't get to change the goals on the plans. Can you imagine that?
Well, yeah, I can if they build in significant ways for the congressman to rip off the system.
There's the B-52, right, which was a brilliant plan, and that, you know, a part of that plane was manufactured in every state of the union. So it was virtually impossible to kill the funding for
and
it.
And they made it bulletproof.
It definitely did.
How does the shuttle stack up as a closed environmental system? Is that a pretty good system? Does it equal the space station?
Well, my understanding is that the shuttle systems work really very well. The trick is it's only semi-closed loop because really every flight is only about 14 days. So the systems they do have to work for 2 weeks, and that makes them, fairly complicated. But it's the long duration aspect of anything that's like an orbital station that really makes them very sensitive and very difficult. For example, I remember there was, shortly after I came to the Johnson Space Center, the Lunar Mars Life Support Test Project was doing another one of their closed-loop runs inside a chamber on the ground testing a bioregenerative life support system that included a chamber of wheat plants, which was doing the gas exchange, the CO2 cleansing for the crew of four who were in the chamber. And someone made up some iron-on transfer T-shirts with the logo for this mission and sent them in through the airlock, just four T-shirts with a few letters and maybe a logo, an iron-on transfer. And within 24 hours, the formaldehyde levels in the system were spiking, and they were getting ready to call an end to the test because they couldn't figure out. At that rate, the plants were going to die. The whole system was going to go down. And they figured out it was the letters on the T-shirts. They had to send them back out through the airlock, and then the system was able to recover after about 48 hours. But this is the kind of threat that you deal with, and when you're in space, it's not that easy to solve a problem like that. The systems have to be relatively robust, but of course the more robust the system is, the more massive it is, the more heat it generates. The more heat any system generates, the more fans have to be applied to move air around. The more fans there are, the louder the acoustic environment inside the space station. Already, our crew lives in an environment anywhere between 72 and 80 decibels all day and all night, just because of the need to move air.
And it takes power.
It's incredibly loud. And it's one of the things that I cannot imagine does not contribute to a real challenge in crew performance. There's no way that it doesn't contribute to it. And the fact that there haven't been any real issues in crew performance is simply a testimony to, the sheer willpower of the astronaut corps. Because there's all kinds of tests were done, by Interpol, by the KGB, by our own guys in the 50s and 60s, most of which have been declassified, on partial sensory deprivation as a tool for interrogating people, right, and breaking down their resistance to interrogation. And within 17 hours of a similar kind of partial sensory deprivation to what the crew live with for months at a time on the space station, subjects were completely broken down. So if you make it difficult for them to hear, if you make it difficult for them to see, already it's difficult for them to feel or touch because of the lack of gravity. It's a big challenge, and it's really a technical risk. It hasn't been treated that way so far, and one of the things I work hard at is conveying in appropriate ways and getting the research done so that we can really demonstrate concretely and objectively, not subjectively, the degree to which and the ways in which various systems interactions incur risk in terms of the crew's performance, in terms of the danger of you know, losing your mission success.
Hold it right there. We need to do our next break.
Okay.
Everybody, don't move. We'll be back with Constance Adams in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
And welcome back, everybody. Our guest today is Constance Adams. And Constance, I have two questions let me throw out at you first from listeners. They've been patiently waiting. This one is related to what we've been talking about. It's from Karen in Ogden, Utah. And she says, regarding the closed-loop systems that you've been discussing, are we now technically capable of developing a decent enough closed-loop system for a lunar settlement so that we could actually talk seriously about building a lunar settlement in 2006 or 2007?
We are certainly able to start talking about it in 2006 and 2007. You know, another one of the challenges of the funding cycles is that some of the really interesting and very good work that the Advanced Life Support team at JSC was doing towards these integrated closed-loop systems was cut when it was only about one-third of the way done. However, in the water loop, very good closure has been achieved both by NASA and by the Europeans with what they call the Melissa loop, and they have now installed the Melissa loop, which is their bioregenerative water reclamation system using a specialized colony of bacteria basically to cleanse all of the water, gray water, black water, condensate, etc., into potable water and put it back in the system. It's at their Concordia research station in Antarctica, and it can support up to 70 people for 3 months at a time. So that's definitely a system that's what I would call exploration class, or in other words, ready to start tweaking so that we could export it to a low-gravity environment like the moon. And, depending upon your balance of plant volume, I mean, in terms of volume and thermal balance, again, is an issue because of light for plant growth. So a bioregenerative plant, gas exchange system or air reclamation system is a little bit farther off. Who is still working on that, though, and making some interesting progress are the former biospherians at the Institute for Ecotechnics at the Synergy Ranch in New Mexico. And they've got their Mars on Earth project and working on lower impact ways of growing plants. So, in other words, needing less power and creating less heat for the same number of plants. We're getting there. And if it were invested in, if the funding were turned back on, I think that those systems could be really fairly sophisticated within a decade.
You're talking about federal funding, correct?
Well, any funding, you know, whatever the
source.
Depending upon who's doing it. But, I mean, it has to be peer-reviewed. It has to be, you know, serious people of all different, from all different, you know, areas need to be able to look at this and reproduce the data. Otherwise, it's just not safe to fly. So that's the danger with some private initiatives, is that there seems to be a sense that whatever they do is proprietary and they don't want to publish it. They don't want others to look at it. They're not sharing all of the real hard information about what they're doing. And I can respect that when we're talking about, you know, a new design for a sewing machine. But when we're talking about something like spaceflight, this is new, it's not marketable, and the fact is it's all about risk. If you can't take advantage of the community of colleagues in terms of getting peer review on your system, then you're just running too much risk.
Dr. Jurist in Montana says, how do you provide redundancy for a closed life support system? If your plants die or get sick, you are SOL.
Well, that's a good point, and I think pretty much everybody I've worked with, and, you know, originally we were working on Mars, now, of course, we're re-gearing to the moon, assumes that there would be some kind of physicochemical system as a backup. And of course, I mean, as I recall, the plans for Mars several years ago, these systems were really very difficult to envision, particularly the air exchange system and the solid waste recovery system in microgravity. It's much easier to adapt them to any kind of a gravity setting. So the assumption was that the crew would make the long transit journey to Mars, or of course the rather shorter transit journey to the moon, using a physicochemical system, and would therefore have only those systems to rely on during an initial, say, 6-week period of time on the surface while the plants grew. So definitely you need more than one kind of system. And that's what, the beauty of the International Space Station, again, is that we've got Russian systems and U.S. systems, and they're completely different from one another, which has, of course, caused some challenges to get them to integrate. But on the other hand, they're really good backups for each other. It's quite a robust system in the end, in ways that really weren't anticipated.
Bill in Virginia says, with an open system, you could potentially do a flush and replace with makeup gas, assuming you had enough. But I would think a closed system would be like a balanced aquarium. The slightest perturbation in the system collapses. Is this a fair analysis?
I think it's not a bad analysis at all. I think it's also, I would like to make a small plug for, you know, we were talking about earlier, my sort of design philosophy, the mothership idea. I don't believe there is any such thing as an open system. The planet's certainly not an open system. It's a closed system, and it's big enough. The buffer size is great enough that it has seemed to be an open system for millennia now. But I think we're all getting pretty clear that flushing a certain gas through the system is going to have impact somewhere else now. I think you all probably talked about the studies done on contrails, for example, and that impact on global dimming. I mean, little things that you don't think of still have a massive impact on the system, so it's definitely closed.
So Earth is a closed system?
Absolutely. Where is it open? I mean, anything that's open is lost to space. That's tragic. You can't replace those resources if it's an open system.
We just think of it being open because it's so huge and big and we don't feel enclosed.
Yep. But I think we're beginning to feel the pinch. If we aren't, then we need to wake up.
Interesting. But Mother Nature provides all the systems to keep it functioning, as long as we keep it in balance.
Well, Mother Nature some would believe that much as our own bodies are made up of thousands or hundreds of thousands of different types of bacteria and other organisms that collaborate so that we can eat, drink, think, smell. Perhaps the planet, the whole biome, is in fact really kind of one complex organism, but it doesn't have to support us. You know, we're here because there's a particular balance of systems that support us. Just as a spacecraft systems, they do have to support a human being. So we're interested in that balance right there, and specifically what is that slice through an ecosystem, albeit a mechanical one, that supports the human being. And, of course, what we're beginning to push the boundaries of in the planetary system is that balance. But it will go on after we are wiped out. There is, the planet was around for a long time before the proper gas combination arose within the atmosphere that began to permit the development of the kinds of life forms that then evolved into the things that we have around us, including ourselves. And it will potentially be around for a long time after that balance is gone. So we need to be very cognizant of these things. I think, and it really is my belief, certainly for me personally, that the research we're doing in closed-loop systems for space flight and for lunar and planetary exploration are actually potentially very useful in terms of helping us strike a better balance on the planet and helping us just live more lightly once we can respect that this is a closed system and tweak our designs to a more efficient way of responding to that system, then the better our chances are of making the kinds of changes that we're going to need to make in the near future to make it work.
Is this perception that you're talking about catching on with not only the people but the science community and politicians, that we're in a closed loop system, and the benefits of doing this research in space have direct benefit to us here on Earth?
Well, I haven't heard too many other people talking about it, but on the other hand, I tend to be pretty busy doing my thing, and I don't talk to a lot of people. But I think it could. I mean, I think the atmosphere is there. You know, it's been primed by a lot of good people. There are other ways of looking at it. In the architectural profession, which, of course, was my Ur profession before I came into space flight, there is a really remarkable spike in the past 5 years, an interest in sustainability and design. Sure, for a lot of people, it's just a buzzword, but for more and more of the profession, this is something they're taking very seriously. And there are a lot of good approaches to sustainability in design of objects and structures for, you know, everyday life that look at the full life cycle of an object, like Bill McDonough's cradle-to-cradle protocol. If you haven't heard of it, you should really look it up. In fact, the cradle-to-cradle protocol is now something that companies can apply for rating on, and they will review the whole life cycle of a product and then, you know, recommend it if it fits. And what that means is it's not cradle to grave. There's nothing that you use and then don't reuse at the end. These are ideas that are out there, and I think it's just a question kind of putting them together. I was able to broker an exchange of a transfer of some of this bioregenerative life support technology, in fact, through the UN Development Program to help address some of the Millennium Development Goals. The MDGs, as you may know, were developed by the UN in the year 2000, and the goal is to reduce by half the extreme poverty by the year 2015, and there are several different areas that they want to focus on, one of which, health, basically involves things like access to clean water and sanitation. And according to the UN statistics, no fewer than 8,000 children die every day just because of a lack of access to clean water, for no other reason than that. And, of course, the total numbers in the area of lack of sanitation also and proper health is more like 40,000. But so we are working on the ESA lab that developed the Melissa Loop is working on a new set of requirements for a similar kind of system that can basically be a kind of countertop system that developed and maintained without using exotic technologies that would allow each household to have a certain degree of autonomy over the cleanliness of their water. So whatever filth they might be downstream from that they put into their system, they can get out potable water that's drinkable and clean for their family. That's not been field tested, I think, yet, but they're working on it.
I've heard said on this show, and I'll say it again, I mean, I have a friend who goes to UCLA, and she spent the summer in and around Arusha, Tanzania, with a group of students that teach AIDS prevention to the people in Tanzania. So they had no water. They had no modern plumbing. They hardly had electricity, certainly not all day long. I mean, when they went to Zanzibar and other places, you know, for weekends and for holidays to see other parts of the area, I mean, these places aren't even like they're in the 21st century. It's amazing. And they had to have bottled water for all the students, you know, to keep them somewhat healthy, had to be really careful with everything they drink and touch. And the level of education in the schools and what they're doing is, I think, primitive is an overstatement. So
probably is. And I think that, you know, well, and of course, as we know, politics and the kinds of structures that we very much take for granted in our Western sort of nationalized, you know, nation-state framework is completely unpredictable in many parts of the world. And I think the question that the gentleman brought up earlier about the need for redundant systems that are different than the type of system that you use as your primary is a very important one. Basically, I think that the greatest resilience one could bring to people struggling in the developing world, or others would call it the southern economies, is to develop systems that each household maintains themselves. They're not relying on anything coming from the outside. They're not expecting any kind of sewage system to work for them, or any kind of water treatment system to work for them. This is something that they can build and maintain themselves, such that even in a state, for example, of civil war, a certain number of people are still able to keep it together. And I suspect that if that's possible, then the devastations and deprivations of those kinds of conflict would be reduced, which tends to reduce and shorten the period of conflict itself. So I think there may be many ways, surprising ways, in which this work that we're doing for exploration of the solar system may save our race, you know, not off-planet.
Tim in Austin, Texas, says, what component does radiation play in your developing closed-loop systems for space? Does it complicate your engineering and your work?
Everything is complicated. My assumption is it's inherently deeply complex, and my challenge, my fun is in simplifying and trying to bring a kind of elegance. But you never get that unless you recognize the complexity. So, yes, it's very complicated, but it's definitely something I take seriously. I am deeply struck by the sheer poetry of the fact that the material that is most effective at shielding life forms that we, as we know them, from all of the different flavors of radiation and the different particles that make up galactic cosmic radiation or the fallout from the Big Bang is water. And here we are, this watery planet. I mean, in fact, the design was very good. It works very well for us. And therefore, it also gives us an opportunity, if we design the vehicle properly, to have redundancy in your in some of your onboard systems. In other words, the crew quarter area of TransHab was the first such design that we did, but I'm now working on other somewhat more sophisticated versions. In TransHab, the crew quarters were surrounded by a wall of that was, in fact, a shear panel that held the longerons together during launch loads. And it was of double thickness with a 10-centimeter gap in between, which is the depth of water that our radiation experts said would be necessary to shield the crew against a solar particle event of the intensity of one that had that was measured in October of 1972. So we just built it, what turned out to be 8 contiguous water tanks of 10 centimeters in thickness into these walls all the way around the crew, so that at least during the 8 hours a day that the crew was in their private quarters, they were completely shielded from radiation, which is a third of the day, so your numbers are good there. And then in the event that we knew some kind of more intense radiation event was coming up, they could take shelter there for whatever period was necessary. And then you've got your water. And so the reason we made it 8 separate tanks was that we could then use those tanks for the whole water purification system and build the water cleansing system into the walls, literally, that went around the crew. So there's a real poetry there.
But as you use the water on the mission, you're depleting your shielding then, right?
No.
So you're not using the water to drink or to...
Well, you're using it, but you're putting it back in at the same time. I mean, you're peeing, and that urine is going into the tanks.
And it somehow is reclaimed and turned back into water.
It is, yes, absolutely reclaimed and turned back into the water by the bacteria in the tanks.
Charming.
It's basically like putting a salt marsh into, you know, just into it, shrinking it down and putting it into a jar. That's how the Earth works, and it works really well.
You told me during the break, and we have about 4 minutes before we leave Seattle, so maybe you'll tell me to do it on the other side, but I wanted you to discuss the mutiny you told me about that I was not aware of.
I believe it was Skylab 3, which was the second crewed Skylab mission, in which the crew, I mean, they were, you know, given a schedule that made absolutely no concessions to the differences in trying to do what seemed like simple tasks like putting on your shoes without gravity. And they were completely exhausted. And they just shut down the radio for 24 hours, which really woke up the guys in mission control to the fact that maybe they weren't controlling the mission. And that maybe we needed to think a little bit about what was going to keep the crew productive and able to function. And it turned around. I mean, there was a complete change in attitude, or at least the beginnings of a change in attitude towards user interface, and sort of supporting the crew in the middle of these missions after that.
Amazing.
Yeah, I think it must have been. I mean, I've, you know, met Chris Kraft and cannot imagine him remaining at all calm during something like that. So I think that must have been quite a moment there. And it's, of course, not talked about much. Unfortunately, it's not talked about much within the program either. I don't remember how I learned about it, but it was somebody was telling a story, and I said, what?
I have not heard about it at all. Constance, before we leave KKNW in Seattle, if people in Seattle have a comment or question, do you want to give out an email address, or should they go through me?
It'd be better if they go through you, just because our email buffers get big. And
okay.
Like
so
I'd be happy to respond.
Follow-up questions or comments if you're listening in Seattle and you can't switch over to thespaceshow.com, click on Listen Live and pick up the rest of the show, or you can do it on archive. Just send it to Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com, and I will forward it to our guest. And, boy, it just seems like there's so much ahead of us that we still need to create and sort of invent and develop to make all of this reliable and safe so that we can have long-term space flight or actual space settlements. You sort of have to get through all of the rhetoric and the huff and puff and the fluff to understand where we're at. But would you say in 1 minute or less, the progress is at a good pace or too slow or really going well? How is our progress on solving all these issues and coming up with solutions?
Well, I think in general, the focus has not been much on solving, you know, more detailed issues. So the progress is not where it could be. But that's, you know, again, politics. You know, I think I welcome, you know, more commercial programs and, you know, mixed programs, because the more people are focusing on these problems, the more likely we are to make good progress.
Okay, hold it there. Seattle, thanks for listening. Again, check us out on the web, pick us up on archives, and we'll be back on the following Tuesday with a live space show. That is the 24th. Everybody, stay right where you are. We'll be right back with the special edition.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody, to The Space Show. This is the special edition. I'm your host, David Livingston. Our guest today is Constance Adams. And Constance, in the email you sent me prior to the show, and then right before we started the program tonight, I asked you to explain the mothership idea. And I think it's really interesting. And can you tell the audience what you're talking about there?
Sure. It's a bit complex. I'm still working on getting the explanation of it down to a good sound bite, but I hope you all are patient with me a little bit. The general concept is that the planet is our mothership. It's the obvious follow through on the understanding that this is a closed loop system. So that works two ways. It's interesting in two ways. It's something I work with in both directions. On the one hand, the way that systems interact on the planet, nature has had millions of years to solve any number of problems about how particular chemicals interact with others, or how different forms of metabolism or other kinds of exchange or fluid exchange and flow can work, and what kinds of structures you want to create to make different kinds of systems function. So, in other words, a lot of these problems that seem to us to be completely new problems may not, in fact, be completely new. They've probably been solved at some point somewhere on Earth. We just don't. The trick is to figure out where it is that they've been solved, and then to use the, you know, whatever skill we can muster to adapt the natural solutions to the kinds of technologies that we're working with. In the other direction, it means too that we can understand the way that our systems work through the ways that natural systems work. For example, just using lessons for how we design spacecraft. A lot of engineers or just system specialists have the goal in the course of their design of what they call optimizing their system. But what you learn if you look at biology and ecology is that any one system optimized, i.e. any one species growing to the extent that it wishes to grow, is going to knock everything else out of balance. That in fact, it's not only maybe not a good idea, but pretty much 100% of the time, a destructive idea for the overall ecosystem. And so that's an important lesson in terms of how you approach the process of designing a spacecraft and looking at all of the integrated systems that you're going to need for any kind of mission. In other words, not to optimize the individual pieces, but to look at the whole and then derive the approach that you want or what your end goals are for each of the systems from that optimized central whole. So there are a couple of different things that we can get from this idea, but fundamentally the planet is the ultimate example of systems engineering, and we can both learn from it, and then we can also apply some of the things that we are developing in our systems engineering and our advanced engineering efforts back towards restoring balance in the planetary system. Kind of long and complicated, I know. But.
How is this idea catching on with your peers?
Well, it seems to, you know, I so far have gotten a lot of very positive feedback. I mostly talk about it with architects because in the engineering context, it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit soft and flaky, maybe, sounding. Although I don't really work with anybody who isn't a devotee of pretty much all science fiction and, you know, not at all surprised by the idea or the analogy of the mothership. But, you know, there's a certain discomfort with language that sounds kind of hippie-ish or New Age, and I can understand that. That's not unreasonable. So, you know, in the immediate context, working at NASA, not really something that I bring up. But folks that I work with, I mean, Synthesis is sort of my own homegrown design group where we do high-performance solutions to various kinds of problems, including architectural ones. And the mothership idea is really the core of our design process there.
This is a question from Bev in Columbus, Ohio. And she says, since you're talking about Earth as a closed system, I'm wondering what your guest thinks about the issues of global warming and how that would relate to making changes or doing things within a closed system, because it must mean that it's happening within the closed system, not outside of the system. I'm hoping I am understanding this right. And again, this is from Bev in Columbus, Ohio.
Well, if I am understanding the question right, that's exactly what I was driving at. The global warming is, of course, the result of sort of the equivalent of those iron-on transfer T-shirts whose plastic in the iron-on bits were off-gassing formaldehydes that were threatening to kill the plants that were keeping the people alive. That's pretty much exactly what the dynamic of global warming is. It's just that because the buffer is so much larger than this relatively small chamber was, it's taken longer for the gases that we're emitting to have a seriously negative effect or a noticeably negative effect on the overall systems that are keeping us alive. But by now, in fact, especially if you live in either of the polar regions, it's unmistakable what's going on. It's unmistakable that things are far out of any kind of natural balance, out of any kind of healthy balance that's good for us, and it's pretty obvious that that change is the result of particular shifts in the composition of the atmosphere, most of which are caused by human activity.
So I've had many guests on the show who say humans can't compare to what Mother Nature does to the atmosphere. So how would you respond to that?
I think that that's I think that that's denial. I think that there's absolutely no way you can look at the way, you know, the planet functioned prior to industrialization and the way that it functions today and has for the past 200 years and really believe that that's true. I mean, it's nice to think that it's not really our fault, but the truth is it is our fault, and we need to take responsibility for ourselves and do something about it.
So you could be having this really cool closed system for a space settlement or a new space station or a new vehicle, and the crew could be doing something that seems benign as hell, and all of a sudden it has an effect in this closed system that is really damaging or destructive or potentially fatal.
Yes, and if the crew are not at least guided by members who are fundamentally scientific in nature, they will die. But you have to be prepared, because this is, you know, one of the things people say, oh, well, anybody should be able to fly. Well, the fact is, what the crew have to figure out how to solve as problems on every single flight, even equipment that we have flown over and over and over again, will suddenly do something completely anomalous. And a crew member has to figure out, with help from the ground, what the problem is and some kind of workaround. That's pretty advanced stuff, and you have to be prepared to do that homework and get it fixed.
Okay.
And if you don't do it, you know, with a fair amount of alacrity, you're not likely to make it. And that's understood. I mean, that's not something that, you know, we have to sit around debating on a day-to-day basis, fortunately, yet, in the human spaceflight program. But I think, and I wanted to add a little note to my previous answer to the previous question, which is that the effect of what Mother Nature's been doing to the atmosphere, I want to reiterate what I was saying earlier, that Mother Nature doesn't, we're not a necessary component of Mother Nature. Nature's planet hasn't always included humans, and it doesn't always have to include us. So I think that the real issue is, do we want to continue to exist on Earth? And if we do, then whatever the source is of the imbalance that is threatening us, we need to take care of it. So debating debating the sources isn't actually productive at this point.
Figuring out how to adapt is much more productive.
Yeah, we just have to fix it. Yeah.
Okay, so time for another reality check as we move toward the end of the show. The private sector, the entrepreneurial community, the really inspired and sometimes very creative group of businessmen and women who want to get us into space, especially orbital space, it seems to me aren't even on the same planet that you and your colleagues are on in trying to figure out these systems. And furthermore, if they did get something up there and they found out something that they were doing was changing their environment rather quickly, would they have the capability, would they have the brain power, would they have the skills and the ground control support to fix the damn problem, or would they perish up there? I'm just sitting here trying to think, what if I'm on a 14-day orbital vacation and a couple of crew members do something, or somebody gets sick, or the air somehow gets contaminated, or something doesn't go according to, you know, the blueprints and the textbooks? You know, in what you're talking about, you've got this phenomenal group of engineers and techies up there as well as on the ground for support to try to resolve the problem and keep people alive and to save the hardware. What's the private sector going to be doing here?
Well, I mean, I think I've met a few of these folks, and there's a wide range of personalities involved, as there is in most things. I think the most important difference I've found. And again, you and I before we started the show were talking about my notion of mystical thinking. I think at the moment the private sector has the kind of mystical thinking that NASA owns all these failures. NASA's old and washed up, and the new, you know, commercial space flight is going to be wonderful. It's going to be great. And which is a fine attitude to have as long as you're able to muster the humility that, to my, you know, astonishment, thousands and thousands of incredibly smart and dedicated men and women in the National Space Program do muster on a daily basis, which is to say, you don't yourself know the answers, or nothing is written in stone. Before I came to where I had a, you know, 12-year professional active career before I came to the Johnson Space Center. So I've got a lot to compare this experience to, and I really had never, ever, ever before been in a situation in which people said, there's no such thing as a stupid question, and meant it. You know, they usually meant it sort of sarcastically or something. But at NASA, it really is genuinely true. I have never been in a meeting or a working group in which people don't say that. If you say, I've got maybe a stupid question, no, there's no such thing as a stupid question, and genuinely they listen to every question. And in my personal experience, 7 times out of 10 I ask a question and the response is, wow, never thought of that before. What would the implications be? You know, something that probably to them, in fact, seemed to be way out in left field, and yet maybe it has significant implications. That's the kind of attitude that has kept as many people alive as you know, have, I mean, we've had, what, 440-some-odd men and women have flown in space now? So,
right.
Yeah, we can talk about the casualties, but, folks, every single success is a miracle of collaboration, and just the extraordinarily high technology that is the human being, the unbeatably high technology that is the human being, and particularly when they don't close off their own faculties, you know, with ideas like, well, this was the plan, or, well, I say it's going to be this way, and therefore, you know. So willpower is a very risky thing to bring with you into space, unless it's got a heavy dose of humility. And I've definitely met some of the, what would they call themselves now, astropreneurs, who have that quality, you know, and really, I think, have what it takes. And I'm excited about the prospects of the various COTS ventures, for example, that folks are entering into with NASA, and a lot of the collaborations coming up. I think the good things will come of it because, as I said, the existing resources are stretched way too thin and focused in specific areas, and there's a lot more that needs to be done, so. But your point is good. I think it's important to focus on safety, and most importantly, you know, this program wasn't created by people who read a lot of history. So it hasn't spent a lot of time and energy writing down what it did or how it solved the problem, you know. So finding out the answers to why certain decisions were made in the past is extremely difficult. As an architect, it's something I just have to do. So I've been very busy, you know, asking all kinds of people over the past decade, you know, why this and why that. But that means that you really need the people who were there the last time this problem came up, who remember how it was resolved or what its source was. And you need them real time, because when the problem comes up real time, you don't usually have a lot of luxury to bang around and try out different things to resolve it. So hopefully, I mean, it is my great hope that the commercial space ventures will be willing to rely upon, you know, NASA resources for real-time advice and support, because it's there, and the fact is, you know, NASA represents a huge amount of the invested intellectual capital of the United States when it was the richest nation on earth in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, that capital is still there, and it's available. It's in the public domain, and all taxpayers pay for it. And I think, I'm pretty sure, I don't know anyone that I work with who wouldn't be more than happy to support in a consulting kind of way, or, you know, in an official or unofficial way, any private space ventures, you know, in to whatever extent that their capabilities were useful. So I hope that attitude could start to prevail and spread, because I think that's what's going to get us there. And I think that without it, you know, some unfortunate things may transpire.
Well, I think it's going to be extremely crucial to do this in the early, in the developing periods. In a more mature industry, it may not be as crucial, but that's not where we're at right now.
Not even close.
Okay, Jack in Atlanta says, I would like to study the type of architecture your guest is talking about. What schools should I go to that teach the type of architecture and closed systems and space architecture that your guest is talking about tonight?
Oh, I wish that I could give you an answer, and I'm working on that. It's just not there yet. Every now and then, you know, there are a couple of programs that we try to, you know, architecture programs that we try to encourage maybe to team up with whatever engineering programs are also in their school to do this kind of work. I've been talking with I've actually been sort of being courted by a university right now, so I don't think I should say any more about that. Maybe to do, you know, to do some teaching and start up maybe some of that discipline. There are it's hard to find. I mean, there are some programs that teach some pieces of what I'm talking about, but the whole thing isn't yet available to study, unfortunately.
So even Rice, which has a good architecture school and is right there in Houston where NASA and the space business and everything is, they don't have space architecture programs?
Well, you know, it's saddening to me. Rice has an extraordinarily good architecture
program. Right, I'm very well aware of that.
Engineering program and very good ties to NASA. But this isn't really where they're at. This is not what they're interested in focusing on. The University of Houston has the Sasakawa International Center for Space Architecture. Those guys, on the other hand, don't work with NASA very much, and they don't work with the University of Houston's also very fine engineering department. So you can get some of the principles studying there, but really the discipline I'm talking about, which is this very embedded systems and very disciplined, you know, not budging the requirements approach to design is not taught, not really what their approach. They have a different approach themselves. So, and the International Space University, ISU, they've got some programs in Strasbourg, which is a beautiful city and a great place to go. And so some of the folks who teach there, and again, I mean, I have also respect for them, but their approach is more one of kind of reviewing the history of what's been done so far in space architecture, which God knows is where you have to start.
What about Japan?
Well, not yet.
Not yet there either.
No, I mean, really, there is not yet a place to do this. I was giving a lecture at MIT last June, and I thought, you know, because that's a place that I don't need to talk to you about the engineering there, and they have an excellent architecture school. And I thought, wow, you know, that would be a really great place to go and do some of that. And I've actually advised a couple of architecture students at MIT who wanted to do thesis work on, you know, say, Mars colonies and needed somebody who really could, you know, work them over pretty hard and make sure that they succeeded. One of whom now works with me on a regular basis at Synthesis. So there are possibilities. There are places where this discipline might spring up in the next few years. But it's not quite there yet. And I wish I had a different answer to give Tim.
What can people expect to see developing over the next couple of years in this field that might be related to the vision for space exploration and ultimately getting us back to the moon and on to Mars? Are there points we should be on the lookout to see if they're developing that would indicate if we're on a good track or not?
Golly, I may be a little too embedded to give you a good answer to that one. I haven't really thought about it in those terms. I think
or milestones, maybe that would be a better way of saying it.
Well, I mean, we need to get Orion flying, the crew expedition vehicle, and we need to get those propulsion systems going. And they don't have to be the NASA versions, but the NASA versions do have to start working. And of course, you know, SpaceX, Kistler, you know, a couple of other folks are trying to develop systems more for suborbital and low orbital propulsion. But I think that once you have a good system going, the trick is figuring out how to expand it. We really, really need another heavy lift launch platform. Once the orbiter is retired, we are collectively hurting, and we're not really going to be able to make any good steps forward until the next heavy lift launch platform is operational. And I don't mean just developmental or being tested, but really working and trustworthy. So that would probably be the major milestone. Other technologies, I don't know. There's a lot in the way of materials research that's still being done. Another thing that would be really important, not for going back to the moon, but for staying there or for any kind of long-duration, further distant exploration, are things that are talked about much but still not quite solved, like a kind of 3D printing system for spare parts, right? So kind of like stereolithography, only not sugar water, but something that could actually make a spare part that you could use. And because, you know, your number one problem after you've solved the sustainable, self-sustaining life support system problem, which is not a small one, but at least partly underway, is fixing things that break, and the things that you don't expect are the ones that are going to break. And so, getting those, you can't have to wait for, the weather conditions at the launch pad to clear up to get a replacement part for an oxygen generator. So that I think those are two technologies that are key to any kind of long-term further work. And then beyond that, we'll see.
Time for one more question for
you.
This is from Benny, and Benny writes us from Norman, Oklahoma, and it's nice to hear from him again. Benny says, in your opinion, Miss Adams, what do you think the survivability of the space program and the vision for going back to the moon and to Mars will be with a political change in Washington, either in the congressional elections or the president?
Well, I have to tell you that so far the vision has been articulated verbally, but it has not been funded. So I don't actually think that its survivability is very good right now.
So the NASA budget of $16 billion a year is not funding the vision?
Well, that's what we were needing just to keep our shuttles flying and get the space station built before the Columbia melted down. And it's what we now are still getting, only we're being sent back to the moon. So I'm not an expert at this, and this is not really my job, but you do the numbers. A vision was articulated, but it wasn't funded. And that's actually not inconsistent with certain other aspects of this administration. So I'm not certain that, that a change in administration wouldn't aid and abet the chances of the return to the moon. You know, depending upon their values. I mean, that's always that's the rub, of course. It's difficult. So far, only a autocratic system has managed to build something like the Great Wall of China, and we've really got to figure out a way around that problem if we're going to move forward.
Constance, it's been delightful, educational, informative. I don't know what to say. You need to come on more often.
I always enjoy chatting with you, David. You throw these curveballs, that are fun, though, to think through. So as long as everybody understands that this is all just my opinion and it's late at night here.
Yes, and I got a new understanding of the term mothership. So this has been a great evening.
Well, it's always fun. Thank you so much, David.
Well, thank you. And
for their patience.
And hopefully you'll come back on down the road, and we'll do this again and see what's developed and what's happening as your work and the work of your associates keeps moving forward.
I look forward to it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Space Show listeners, Friday morning, Dr. Sam Dinkin is with us. Space Shot, don't miss the program, 9:30 a.m. Pacific Time. Good night, everyone.